It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
So this week, I spoke to James Shaw a lot about sort of the different climate policies that are going on in New Zealand. We talked firstly about the emissions trading scheme, which I feel like to a lot of people was potentially a little bit dry, but it's an incredibly important piece of legislation. And with the new reforms, they're looking at introducing sort of a transparency idea around it. So it's really important that people know about it. We'll also talk a little bit about how our climate policies affect the Pacific and the autonomy of Pacific nations. And finally, we do, he gives us a little brief talk about his thoughts on the cannabis referendum. So here is James. So just to begin with, as we've just sort of said, the emissions trading scheme is not a particularly interesting piece of legislation, and it can sort of, I think, to a lot of people, it does seem complicated and not easily explained. So could you briefly explain what the emissions trading scheme does and how the recent reforms will change the way the scheme works in New Zealand?
Sure. So the emissions trading scheme works by putting a price on the amount on the amount of pollution that any one company is allowed to emit in any given year, and so the idea is that it's what we call a cap and trade. So that there's supposed to be a sort of a total volume cap about how much greenhouse gas emissions, how much pollution we're allowed to put into the atmosphere every year, and then the idea is that you know, companies have to kind of either limit their emissions within that or buy the right to, you know, to pollute, I guess, from another company who's able to drive their emissions down further. The problem that we've had is that there's been no cap. So it's been a cap and trade with no cap. So our emissions have actually just kept increasing over the course of the last 10 years that we've had this game. And that's really the kind of basis of the big package of reforms that we're putting through, is we're putting in this cap and then we're going to slowly crank it down over time.
So could you just tell us what these reforms are exactly?
Well, so last week we announced the second tranche of a set of three tranches of decisions about how the reformed emissions trading scheme is going to work. This set of decisions were pretty in fact they're all pretty technical, but these were really about how we're going to improve the market, and in particular you know, sort of from a governance and oversight perspective, because you know, you can imagine in the future when that cap is lower and the supply of units is much lower, that prices will go up and there'll be much greater incentive for people to game the system, to cheat, and so on. And so what we want to do is we want to just basically make sure that it's a really transparent and open marketplace that people can see into and can see exactly what's going on and who's got what.
Now, when it comes to that transparency, and obviously that transparency is there to exists to ensure that people are doing what they're supposed to do under the emissions trading scheme. However, the emissions trading scheme, for as long as it's existed, has sort of been quite a dry topic.
Yeah.
And something that I don't know whether a lot of the population know a lot about and how it works. So how are we going to ensure that people are going to read into the emissions trading scheme and see what emissions various participants are using, and how are we going to make sure that people are actually interested to have a look at that and actually hold people accountable?
Well, so there's a couple of things. I think, in you know, for the population at large, it actually doesn't matter that they aren't terribly interested in it, because you know, I guess your average sort of person on the street doesn't interact with it on a daily basis. But it is important that the regulators have got good oversight and that they can see what's going on. I think it's actually important that the companies that are participating in the scheme can see what's going on and that it's transparent to them, so they feel like, you know, they've been treated fairly and that, you know, other people in the scheme aren't kind of cheating the system. That's really important to the integrity of it. And I also think that there are groups out there, like, you know, whether it's Greenpeace or Forest and Bird or World Wildlife Fund, you know, who are, they kind of keep a close eye on these sort of activities on behalf of the general population. And so I think that's an added accountability layer besides having a government regulator.
So just moving on, talking about the emission trading scheme's reforms, and then also with the Zero Carbon Bill coming into Parliament over the last couple of weeks, I wanted to talk a little bit about how New Zealand's climate change policies will affect the larger Pacific. I just wanted to know, do we owe a climate responsibility to the smaller nations of the Pacific and the wider Pacific altogether?
Yes, we do, and we're actually very conscious of that. So the way that we interact with it, well, there's a whole series of sort of dimensions to our climate, how our climate policy interacts with the Pacific. First of all, you know, in the Zero Carbon Bill that we announced last week, we've got this overriding purpose of New Zealand operating within the envelope of 1.5 degrees of global warming. And that is incredibly important to the islands, particularly the low-lying atoll states, because if we allow global warming to get north of 1.5 degrees, that dramatically increases the chances that those islands will lose all of their territory and that their people have to move somewhere else. So the 1.5 degree temperature goal is written into the Paris Agreement for precisely that reason, to protect the small island states. So it's very important to them that New Zealand shows leadership by saying, look, the overall goal that we're aiming for is that 1.5 degrees. So that's one thing. Second thing is that, you know, our aid program is heavily geared towards adaptation activities and sort of helping the islands to become more resilient in the face of the increasing and more severe cyclones that we're seeing there. And we increased the aid budget by 50%. Last year, in last year's budget, and much of that is geared towards helping the islands to adapt to the effects of climate change, as well as actually to put in place their own measures. So we've been, for example, we've been very heavily involved in helping to install solar power in much of the islands, which both helps with their reducing their own greenhouse gas emissions, gets them off diesel generators, but it also really helps with their balance of payments because it means that they're producing electricity onshore, not having to import their energy, and so on. So, you know, we're very active in that area.
Is this action by New Zealand something that Pacific nations are generally very open to, or are there concerns when it comes to the autonomy of the island's own development and climate change action, and whether that's threatened by larger countries coming in and saying, oh, we'll sort it out, we've got you?
Yeah, no, that's something that we're really conscious of, and I think that there certainly was a time when New Zealand and Australia had, you know, very kind of paternalistic, kind of neo-colonial approach, and you know, we've kind of learned, I think, the mistakes of that approach. And so the way that we work is we say, okay, well, you know, we consider that we've got this responsibility, but actually the response needs to be led by the islands themselves. And so we have this ongoing dialogue with the islands where essentially they tell us where they think the investment needs to go, and then we work with them in those areas. And we don't do something that, you know, when we're really clear, they don't think is in their best long-term interests.
And I suppose that is really important, considering there are many nations in the Pacific and all have different cultural backgrounds, cultural ideas about how, I don't know, how they run their own societies. And you can't just have a, you know, one-size-fits-all sort of blanket way of working with everyone. Is that correct?
Yeah, you absolutely cannot. And there are also many other outside countries that are operating in the Pacific as well who have, you know, should we say, different approaches. And so it is really important to us that we kind of work really carefully with the multilateral environment to kind of say, look, you know, this has to be in the best interests of the islands.
Fantastic. I was just wondering, just lastly, whether I could just get your brief thoughts, because I know we haven't talked to you about this and I know it's been a couple of weeks, but just your brief thoughts on the cannabis referendum.
Yeah, well, we're delighted that there's going to be a referendum, as was outlined in our confidence and supply agreement, and also pretty pleased that we're going to have a piece of draft legislation, so it's really clear what the model is that we're proposing. So we were kind of conscious that, and I guess had learned the lessons of Brexit, which is you've got to be careful what you're asking for, because people have very different ideas. But my sense is that we're kind of winning the argument based on the evidence, which is that, you know, if you actually want to reduce the incidence of people using cannabis, and if you actually want to reduce harm, then a regulated market model, a very tightly regulated market model, tighter even than we've got for alcohol and tobacco, is actually a much better model than essentially black market, which is what we've got at the moment.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.